Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an emergency private briefing from members of the House of Representatives called for by the head of the National Security Agency, General Keith Alexander, aimed at stopping an amendment authored by Republican Justin Amash and Democrat John Conyers that would curb the NSA's authority to collect communications data on millions of Americans. James Bamford, an investigative journalist who has written a number of bestsellers about the NSA, joins us to discuss the preliminary damage control at the NSA that indicates Edward Snowden did not access the agency's crown jewels. Then we'll talk about the bankruptcy of Detroit, where a very small part of the problem, the pensions of public employees, is being exaggerated by the governor of Michigan, Rick Snyder, who is scapegoating public employees and their unions in line with the ideological game plan of other right-wing Republican governors in Wisconsin and Ohio. Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter Ellen Schultz, the author of Retirement Heist, How Companies Plunder and Profit from the Nest Eggs of American Workers, joins us to discuss how the pension benefits protected by state law ended up on the table in Detroit's bankruptcy proceedings. Then finally, we'll examine how the largest banks are profiting from manipulating the price of commodities, which was the subject of a hearing today before the United States Banking Subcommittee. Sole Amarova, a professor of law at the University of North Carolina who specializes in regulation of financial institutions, banking law, international finance, and corporate finance, joins us to discuss her testimony today and the need for the public to gain awareness of how much the price of food, gas, and electricity is being driven up by the big Wall Street banks who profit at the expense of ordinary consumers. And joining us now is James Bamford, who's an investigative journalist specializing in national security issues. He was the Washington investigative reporter for ABC's World News Tonight and is the author of the best-selling books Body of Secrets, The Puzzle Palace, and The Shadow Factory, Inside the Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to Spying on America. His most recent blog at Wired Magazine is Connecting the Dots on PRISM, Phone Surveillance, and the NSA's Massive Spy Center, which focuses on the deception of the American public propagated by top officials at the NSA. Welcome to Background Briefing, James Bamford.
Thanks, Ian. I appreciate it.
And General Alexander, of course, is calling on members for a special top-secret briefing to head off this effort on the part of two Republican congressmen, one a libertarian Republican and the other a fairly stalwart progressive, John Conyers. But in the article that you wrote recently at Wired, the secret war, infiltration, sabotage, mayhem, for years, four-star General Keith Alexander has been building a secret army capable of launching devastating cyber attacks. Now it's ready to unleash hell. And that came out on June the 12th. But in your article, you quote a former senior CIA official who's talking about General Alexander, and quoting him, he said, "Inside the government, the general is regarded with a mixture of respect and fear, not unlike J. Edgar Hoover. We jokingly referred to him as Emperor Alexander, with good cause, because whatever Keith wants, Keith gets. We would sit back literally in awe of what he was able to get from Congress, from the White House, and at the expense of everyone else." So, given that quote, I imagine that General Alexander is going to end up with the House of Representatives in the palm of his hands.
Well, that's the way it's been in the past. We'll see if there's any changes now. In the past, really the only people that have ever tried to stand up against them were Senator Udall and Senator Wyden, who really were the only two people that made any effort to try to stop the NSA from its massive collection of telephone numbers and other kinds of data, email, metadata, and so forth. They were really the only ones. But after the revelations, and there were, I think there was a letter signed by 26 senators asking that more details, more information on these programs be released. So it's an indication that the revelations have caused a number of people in Congress to rethink all this freedom that's been given to NSA and think about the consequences of it. And I think we'll have, you know, when this vote is taken, we'll have a bit of a insight into how widespread this disenchantment and worry about the NSA is.
The vote will be taken later this week. In polls, a Quinnipiac poll recently indicated that there's been a tremendous shift in public opinion in the last couple of years. Only about a year or two ago, the majority of Americans felt that the government wasn't doing enough in using surveillance for anti-terrorism. And now it's flipped, and the majority of Americans feel that the government is doing too much. And also the poll indicated that a majority of Americans see Edward Snowden not as a traitor but as a whistleblower. What's your sense then of this top secret SCI level briefing that Alexander's going to give, SCI, Special Compartmental Information briefing? Is there any way to gauge the mood? Because, you know, it's one thing, the public is one thing, but the press and the politicians are another. And I haven't heard an awful lot from the politicians, except the president, oddly enough, who called for a national debate on civil liberties versus national security, which conspicuously hasn't happened.
Well, that's right. You know, the problem is that people, especially in the House, they run for election every 2 years, and they're always very afraid of voting against somebody like General Alexander, which is why he has so much power, because he goes in there and asks for something, and they get very concerned, because if they say no, and then the next election they have an opponent who comes up and ends up using that as a billy club against them to basically accuse them of being weak on terrorism. And they're especially worried that, you know, something may happen, like Boston or whatever, and then all of a sudden they'll be accused of being responsible for having cut the budget or cut the funding for a program like the one that's being debated here.
Well, that's the old soft on communism, soft on terrorism trap, right? That all politicians are terrified of. But what about responding to the public's outrage?
Well, again, I think the public's outrage has been growing. It didn't start off this way. It started out fairly mildly, and I think over the past month, it's been growing as the revelations have come out. Unlike most leaks where you have like one revelation or one news story, one news cycle about an event, this has been going on for a month where there have been multiple leaks in various different countries. And it looks very bad because the United States has become the world's spy, basically, spying on everybody. Other countries spy also, but the problem is that the United States has all the internet companies located here, and the U.S. can put pressure on these companies that other countries can't really do. So I think people are starting to understand that just because you have the NSA director saying that all this is needed, and they start thinking, well, why do they need to know that, three times a day I call my grandmother next door in Topeka, Kansas, or whatever. What's the value of storing all these records? And, you know, one of the more interesting details here was that the NSA up until 2011 was also collecting all the metadata from internet communications, email, and so forth. And then the only reason it was stopped was because Wyden and Udall basically asked Alexander to put up or shut up. In other words, show us how this program has succeeded. You keep saying how valuable it is. Well, let's see. Show us how it succeeded. And they weren't able to do that. And as a result, they had to shut the program down in 2011. And so, you know, I'm not a total pessimist on this. I think, you know, once sometimes if a congressman or a senator sees right in front of your eyes that this is an illusion, that this is protecting us and it's costing billions, and then you have all this anger from the public, that may change things.
Again, I'm speaking with James Bamford, who's an investigative journalist specializing in national security issues. He was a Washington investigative reporter for ABC's World News Tonight and is the author of the best-selling books Body of Secrets, The Puzzle Palace, and The Shadow Factory, Inside the Ultra-Secret NSA, From 9/11 to Spying on America. His most recent blog post at Wired magazine is Connecting the Dots on PRISM, Phone Surveillance, and the NSA's Massive Spy Center, which focuses on the deception of the American public propagated by top officials at the NSA. So specifically, the Amash Amendment, which again is co-sponsored by John Conyers, it would put the House of Representatives on record, and it's attached to a Pentagon spending bill that would end the authority for the blanket collection of records under the Patriot Act, and bars the NSA and other agencies from using Section 215 of the Patriot Act to collect records, including telephone calls that pertain to persons who are not subject to investigation under Section 215. And, Jim, I've talked to some lawyers in Washington who actually are petitioning the Supreme Court over the legality of the FISA court's use of Section 215. On the basis that it pertains to an ongoing investigation. And they are arguing that how can wiretapping and getting the information on millions and millions of Americans be part of an ongoing investigation? Does that mean that every American is a terrorist suspect? That's the basis of their lawsuit. So there's a certain level of absurdity in this. There's, the big brother, the machine has gone mad by the look of it. I mean, isn't that what's going on here? That so much of what is happening is massive, massive data collection is going on, and this is the future. But to have this incredible machine that gathers all this information and has all these complicated algorithms, to have it dedicated to catching a couple of idiots from a cave somewhere in Afghanistan just seems to be so out of whack. But is that what it comes down to?
Well, that's what I've been arguing for years. I've been writing about how NSA is out of control for years in a book, my most recent book on NSA, and the article I wrote on their huge data center in Utah last year for Wired, and then this year the cover story for Wired on General Alexander. It's what happens when you give an agency basically carte blanche and absolute secrecy. Carte blanche to have as much money as it wants, basically, and absolute secrecy into how they spend it. And that's been going on since 9/11. The agency, it's like a machine that just keeps eating and eating and eating. You keep feeding it, and it keeps eating. And as long as they keep feeding money into it, it's going to keep gobbling up information. That's what the NSA does. That's its job. That's what it considers its responsibility, to gather as much information as possible.
Right, but isn't that reminiscent of the racket that went on during the Cold War, the deterrence racket, that there was never enough deterrence, so we had to keep building the triad and the missiles and the submarines and the bombers, and the other side did the same, and they kept, building these things ad infinitum because there was never enough deterrence. The same illogic applies here, doesn't it? There's never enough information.
Well, exactly. It's the same paradigm, basically. You have a group of people, and their whole goal in life is gathering information, and the more money you give them, the more information they're going to collect, whether it's useful or not, is almost beside the point. I mean, if you look at all these past terrorist incidents, well, first of all, just to look at NSA, NSA was never designed for this. It's not what NSA was created for. It was created for one purpose, and that was to detect and prevent a surprise attack, nuclear surprise attack, from Russia to get early warning before they are launching a nuclear weapon and to gather intelligence on the development of nuclear weapons. It wasn't designed to chase people around the world or tap everybody's phone call to see who calls whom. That began after 9/11, and you're taking this agency that had no purpose and never was designed for this and trying to turn it into something that it doesn't do very well. I mean, it keeps missing terrorist incidents no matter what they're doing. They missed the first World Trade Center bombing. They missed the attack on the USS Cole. They missed the attacks on East embassies, U.S. embassies in East Africa. They missed 9/11. And then even after 9/11, they missed the Times Square bomber, the underwear bomber, and the Boston bombers. Now, all those people were communicating internationally, overseas, either completely overseas, like the underwear bomber who was in Yemen and Nigeria, or the Times Square bomber who was communicating back and forth to Pakistan, and the Boston bombers were communicating back and forth to Chechnya and Dagestan. That's where the NSA's responsibility is. It's to focus on foreign communications and international communications, not domestic telephone records and domestic communications. I mean, one of the reasons they probably missed all these is because they've been focusing in the wrong places. So these people haven't been calling Kansas City, they've been calling Pakistan. And by diverting your resources and your attention to catching finding out how many times a day the grandmother in Topeka, Kansas calls her next door neighbor, it's just flooding you down with useless information.
So, James Bamford, just in the last couple of minutes, just turning to the Edward Snowden case, and of course, I don't know what General Alexander is going to be telling the Congress members at this secret, private, top secret briefing he's giving them. Presumably, he's got some answers to give. But my understanding from preliminary leaks about the ongoing damage assessment at the NSA indicates that the crown jewels, as they refer to them, that's the ECI, the extremely compartmentalized information, that Snowden did not have access to that. He did, however, have access to a good deal of information that was concentrated in one portion of the NSA's computer system. So what do you know about the damage control that's going on?
Well, I think it was began the minute they discovered that, that he was responsible for the leaks. And normally it should be fairly easy to track, to do what's called an audit to find out who accessed what. All they have to do is go to his laptop, or rather his computer, his office computer that was connected to the NSA, and do an audit trail on it, see where he went, what communications data he accessed, which files he went into, and so forth, and what he's downloaded. So normally that would probably take, I guess, a month to be very thorough, so that's probably what they're just finishing up is doing that. So then they probably have an idea now, not necessarily what he has on him, but at least what he may have on him, because they would know what files he went into and what files he didn't go into. And apparently from this most recent article or this most recent report from CNN, he wasn't able to get into what they call the extremely sensitive information, the ESI files. Those files are probably deal with crypt analysis. In other words, which encryption systems in China or wherever have been broken and those kind of things. Because he certainly got information that was extremely sensitive, as sensitive as you can get at NSA, such as which companies are cooperating, which links are being tapped, which foreign communications, foreign countries are gathering all this information from. and access to the FISA surveillance orders. So,
and I take it
by the NSA saying this, they're just opening the door for somebody for the next whistleblower to say, well, that's going to be my target.
Right. Well, it seems like they want it both ways. They're saying the sky is falling. This guy's done terrible damage. And now they're saying, well, he didn't really get the crown jewels. So it's a bit of a mixed signal, isn't it?
Well, it's sort of juvenile. So it's sort of, you know, okay, you robbed my house, but you didn't get my photo album or something. Mm-hmm. You know, I don't know what to make of it, except it sounds like sour grapes from NSA saying, well, okay, you did all this damage, but you didn't do as much damage as you might have wanted to.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, James Bamfin.
Oh, my pleasure, Ian. Thanks for having me on your show.
Again, I've been speaking with James Bamfin, who's an investigative journalist specializing in national security issues. He was the Washington investigative reporter for ABC's World News Tonight and is the author of the best-selling books Body of Secrets, The Puzzle Palace, and The Shadow Factory, Inside the Ultra-Secret NSA from 9/11 to Spying on America. His most recent blog post at Wired Magazine is Connecting the Dots on PRISM, Phone Surveillance in the NSA's Massive Spy Center, which focuses on the deception of the American public propagated by top officials at the NSA. We're going to take a brief station break, and we're back looking into why the pension benefits protected by state laws ended up on the table in Detroit's bankruptcy proceedings.
Postcard, drop me a line, stating point of view. Indicate precisely what you mean to say. You're sincerely wasting away. Give me your answer, fill in a form, mine forevermore. Will you still need me? Will you still feed me when I'm 64?
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Ellen Schultz, who's an investigative reporter who has covered the retirement crisis for more than a decade. Formerly with The Wall Street Journal, her reporting has led to congressional hearings, proposed legislation, and investigations by the Treasury and the GAO. She's won dozens of journalism awards for economics, financial, investigative reporting, and including 3 Polk Awards, 2 Loeb Awards, and a National Press Club Award. In 2003, Schultz was part of a team at the Wall Street Journal that was awarded the Pulitzer Prize for articles on corporate scandals. Her latest book is Retirement Heist: How Companies Plunder and Profit from the Nest Eggs of American Workers. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ellen Schultz.
Hi, Ian.
And Ellen, what's your sense of how the governor Michigan, Rick Snyder, appears to have exaggerated the pension problem here. They're talking about a bankruptcy that could amount to $20 billion in terms of Detroit, of $3.5 billion of which is pension benefits, which are supposed to be protected by state laws, but the city's emergency manager has included them among the $11 billion in unsecured debt. So it seems that disproportionately the public employees' pensions are being targeted here.
Well, the public employees have always been convenient scapegoats for all of the bad governance out there. This has been going on for decades, and I first noticed this starting in the 90s, that it began to accelerate, where you had a strong call to eliminate public pensions because they were supposedly too rich. They were bankrupting, the counties. This just isn't the case. There is a problem of underfunding in public pensions, and places like Detroit are absolute examples of how bad it can get. However, they aren't the cause of the problems. And Detroit is putting the finger on public employees because they're convenient. And they are confident that if they can pull this off, plenty of other places will be doing the same. It's not going to solve a financial problem, especially if listeners out there are thinking, well, okay, what about my municipality or county or state? What about those guys making, you know, these fat pensions? Well, news about that, the pensions aren't as fat as you think. You know, they often include the equivalent of Social Security. And so that might account for, let's say, a $40,000 pension. If $24,000 of that is Social Security, and another $10,000 is the equivalent of the person's savings, that doesn't look quite so rich after all. So they're not quite as rich, and the liabilities are very plastic. You can do a lot with the numbers, and it is true. Many, many local politicians in league with unions in some cases exaggerated the numbers. They lowballed them when they wanted to make liabilities look low, but now they're pushing them up, you know, with different kinds of assumptions to make them look worse than they are. And obviously there's a bit of political push on this.
Well, it would seem that there's a lot of these Republican governors in Wisconsin and Ohio and, of course, now in Michigan are working on the same game plan. And it seems that the subtext for going after public employees is to break their unions who give money to the dreaded Democrats, isn't it? I mean, without being conspiratorial, isn't it pretty obvious that there's a political motive here?
Well, certainly there's a political motive, but there's also the anti-tax, anti-government button, which is very easy to hit. Anybody who is unhappy about their property taxes or who's had a bad experience at the DMV or the post office loves to think, you know, ill of public employees. So you can tap into that vast reservoir of you know, hate and annoyance that some people have and get them sort of on board with this in a sort of mob of people trying to deconstruct the whole system. It has been an enormously successful system. It has provided a lot of stability. One research shows that when people retire, you know, that the public employees retire, they tend to retire in their communities, and their pensions provide revenue and tax revenue in those communities. So they're a stabilizing force. The money isn't just vanishing into the ether. So it's really short-sighted to try and pull the plug on some of these pensions or even to cut them. It's just an astonishing legal turn that we're seeing.
Well, it seems of the 21,000 retired municipal employees whose pensions are now on the table in Detroit, a lot of them are retired police officers and firefighters who receive an average of $30,500. But they don't pay into the Social Security system, so they don't receive Social Security benefits upon retiring. So when you factor that in, it's not such a great deal, as you were pointing out earlier. And you would think that going after the police and the firefighters is not exactly popular, but the governor on television on Sunday, Rick Snyder, said that the debt question needs to be addressed, and there needs to be some accountability to the citizens of Detroit. They are not getting the services they deserve, and they haven't for a very long time. So this sounds like he's on some kind of a jihad against the public employers.
They're just so convenient. It's almost like there's this confluence of this perfect storm of forces arrayed against them. It's so easy to pick on in many ways because public records provide access to the salaries, to the pensions. And if you take a look and dig around, you can very often find abuses in various places. Not that we don't have abuses in corporate America. So you will find the occasional ludicrous pension going to somebody or some abuses of the disability system. These are seized upon by the media. And then, of course, they go out, you know, the public hears about these things. They don't hear about the millions and millions of good, solid plans out there with people who don't have fantastically large pensions. They just have modest pensions after a lifetime of work And those pensions include a lot of their own savings. So they didn't just turn, you know, get a paycheck. Part of that paycheck was diverted into these plans for years.
So, there are broader issues at play here. And again, it seems that the focus, Alan Schultz, is on the public employees, and they're going to take a hit. You know, the population of Detroit has shrunk from 1.8 million to about 700,000 in the past 6 decades. So there are bigger forces at play here, surely. I mean,
Absolutely. It's not just the shrinking of the population and the change of demographics. It's all the market forces. It's that, you know, is ground zero for manufacturing. All of that has affected Detroit. And when you pull all that together and you add poor governance, those are the causes of the problems there, not the public employees.
So is this, you know, going to be sort of just you're going to break this city and then it's going to be up for a fire sale? I mean, what is the governor planning here in terms of going after the pensions and then turning around and saying that they're going to come out stronger at the other end? I'm not sure what the game plan is here. Do you have any idea?
Well, I can't speculate what's going on in their mind, but clearly if they, you know, have their wish, then it's clear that what they want to do is to be able to adjust pensions, i.e. cut them, even for people who have been retired for years. So if they are able to do that, there will be challenges in court. This isn't just going to happen. It'll go up on appeal. There will be all kinds of hopefully checks on this this runaway train. But certainly that is a desire, this long-term desire to take away pensions from public employees.
Well, they're already apparently, the city's now calling, and of course you have a kind of lame duck mayor who's a former basketball player who seems to have been sort of cut off at the knees by the person that the Governor Snyder picked, this Kevin Orr, who is the receiver and seems to be running the show. Already they've called on the judge, the federal judge that's handling this, to stop and reject any further lawsuits, you know, unions, et cetera, suing. I guess it will come down to the federal courts having domination over state law. Is that at the end of the day, if the state law says that the pensions are protected by the Michigan Constitution, the feds can ignore that?
You know, I don't know how it works with that type of law. Normally, federal law preempts state law. On the other hand, states do have a certain amount of sovereignty over things within the states. So I couldn't speculate on how the legal part of that will shake out without looking into it.
But it does. If the fact that they're already saying they're going to reject any further lawsuits would indicate to me that already the door is closing on a lot of people, or it looks like it could.
Well, I think we're in an interesting testing period because there hasn't been something quite this dramatic that has gotten quite such public attention. You know, there have been problems with pensions, say, in San Diego and elsewhere, but people didn't see that such an assault on the actual pensions themselves. You know, there was a lot of blame going around, especially leveled at public employees. But this is a sort of a test case in some ways, and it will be important to see how it shakes out in the coming months.
Well, Alan Schultz, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
My pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Alan Schultz, who's an investigative reporter who has covered the retirement crisis for more than a decade. Formerly with the Wall Street Journal, her reporting has led to congressional hearings, proposed legislation, and investigations by the Treasury and the GAO. She has won dozens of journalism awards for economics, financial, and investigative reporting, including 3 Polk Awards, 2 Loeb Awards, and the National Press Club Award. In 2003, she also was a part of a team at the Wall Street Journal awarded the Pulitzer Prize for articles on corporate scandals. Her latest book is Retirement Heist, How Companies Plunder and Profit from the Nest Egg of American Workers. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back looking into how the big banks are profiting from manipulating the price of commodities.
From out the road when he get dough was horrible. Time is money, spend, wait, save, invest, affest. The 10K cave a chicken chest, S. Yes, y'all are double, get your trickles. The best ballers pitch in and rub to get a nickels. But tut tut, he bout to change the price again. They go up each time, he blow up like hydrogen. Villain here, albums shrilling in fear. And won't stop top bill until he a gazillionaire. Villain, his agenda is clear. Ending this year with dividends to spare here. A new meaning to sales through the roof.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Soleil Amirova, who is a professor of law at the University of North Carolina, where she focuses on regulation of financial institutions, banking law, international finance, and corporate finance. In 2006 and 2007, she served at the U.S. Department of Treasury as a special advisor for regulatory policy to the Undersecretary for Domestic Finance. Welcome to Background Briefing, Soleil Amirova.
Thank you very much, Ian.
And today you testified in the United States Senate before a Senate subcommittee on financial institutions and consumer protection, a subcommittee of the Banking Committee chaired by Senator Sherrod Brown. This is in response, I take it, to the New York Times story that was front page on Sunday revealing how Goldman Sachs has bought a company and warehouses aluminum ingots, which they sort of shuffle around in a kind of shell game, presumably to drive the price up of these commodities. So let's begin with that. Was this hearing in response to the New York Times article?
I don't think it was actually in response to the New York Times article. I think New York Times article and the hearing are both responding to the same trends that have been kind of at the center of attention, at least of certain people who followed banks and banks' involvement in commodities for quite some time. So, to me, this is a great fortunate timing, but I wouldn't necessarily say that the hearing was directly in response to the New York Times piece.
But the hearing is basically looking into Wall Street's ownership of warehouses, pipelines, and other commodity-related assets.
That's exactly right, yes.
Because I recall back in 2008, for example, 60 Minutes broke a story. That was when the price of gasoline went up to $147 a barrel. And 60 Minutes revealed that the biggest owner of oil at the time was J.P. Morgan Chase, and that they were filling up tankers that sort of, you know, steamed around in circles, holding all of this oil off the market in order to drive the price up. So we get these anecdotal stories, but we don't get the overall picture of how much these basic commodities like food and gasoline that consumers have to pay for and how much the prices are inflated. So was there a big picture presented today to the Senate?
Well, there was certainly an attempt made to present a picture that is, more complete than what we usually know and hear about. Is it possible to present in a single hearing the complete picture of such a complex phenomenon? Perhaps not. So my hope is that this hearing is only the beginning of a serious inquiry process into exactly the kinds of connections that you are pointing out. The fact is that what happens in the secretive world, for example, of oil trade and the oil derivatives trade, the financial instruments trade that is linked to the price of oil, to what extent those activities directly affect the price of gasoline that everyday ordinary Americans have to pay every day, that's actually quite a complicated question. And I'm hoping that, you know, by looking into the kind of legal and policy implications of allowing the J.P. Morgans and Goldman Sachs of this world to get engaged in this kind of market, we will at least start getting some tangible answers that would allow us to figure out whether or not such a connection actually exists.
Well, it does feel very coincidental that all of a sudden, on the biggest driving weekend of the summer, suddenly oil prices go up, and they've been going up arbitrarily here in California. I mean, I think one can rightly have a healthy suspicion that the market's being gamed, because at the time that oil was up at $147 a barrel, the Saudis were saying, it's not us, it's not us, you know.
Of course, yeah. No, I completely agree with you. And in fact, I do share your suspicion. It is absolutely a legitimate question to be asked, because for example, financial institutions will tell us is that the fluctuations of gas prices and oil prices are determined as usual by the normal interaction between supply and demand. But it doesn't explain the swings and the sort of incredible, unprecedented rise, even in the kind of magnitude of prices of a single barrel of oil in the past decade. And of course, it did coincide with the financialization of commodities markets. So it coincided with the expansion of the financial institutions into commodities markets, both on the financial side, but also very importantly on the physical side. It also expanded with, you know, along with the kind of influx of purely financial investors into the commodities as an asset class. And again, one might ask, why would investors start seeking, you know, investments in commodities that, you know, while financial investments seem to be directly affecting actual cash prices, right, in the spot markets. So one possible answer would be is that the same financial institution, same Goldman Sachs and Morgan Stanley of the world, are actually marketing these types of financial products to potential investors. So this what you call the gaming of the market is a very multi-layered phenomenon, right? It's not just a simple kind of manipulation of prices. But it's also changing the underlying dynamics of price determination in these markets to introduce factors that typically have not been part of that dynamics, like financial speculative interests, for instance.
And again, I'm speaking with Soleil Omarova, who's professor of law at the University of North Carolina, where she focuses on regulation of financial institutions, banking law, international finance, and corporate finance. In 2006 to 2007, she served at the United States Department of the Treasury as a special advisor for regulatory policy to the Undersecretary for Domestic Finance. So, but it's worth noting that this new, the financialization of commodities, as you have put it, that's through what is called the Goldman Sachs Index. And it has obviously attracted an enormous amount of speculative money. And traditionally, the commodities markets were dictated by end users of commodities, like oil refineries who would be interested in the price of oil, and they would want to cover their bets and try and look ahead and get the best price. And the same with Pillsbury and all these big companies like Kellogg's. They'd be interested in the price of grain. And in response to this New York Times story about how Goldman Sachs, through its ownership of Metro International Trade Services, have been warehousing aluminum ingots and sort of doing a shell game, shuffling them around from warehouse to warehouse to drive the price up. That, of course, has attracted the ire of the big beer brewing companies who need the aluminum for their aluminum cans. So is this the problem, is that a market that was normally driven by the end users has now been taken over by speculators?
That is definitely a part of the problem, you know. Like I said before, and like you said just now, traditionally these markets, be it commodity futures or, you know, even more so, actual physical commodities markets, were you know, dominated by producers of those commodities, traders who are not financial institutions, and end users. And so the supply and demand really drove a lot of the pricing there. And when supply and demand for actual production enterprises of metals or oil or whatever the commodity we're talking about determines the price for that commodity, then there is sort of a natural level, right, within which, or a natural range within which such prices may fluctuate from time to time. However, once you introduce this whole new class and potentially unlimited class of players into that market, those are the players that have no commercial end-user type interest in the underlying commodity, but only viewing it as an asset class, right? Same as potentially maybe securities or whatever else, mortgages. And now they're investing in commodities or commodity futures, for example. Then those investors with a lot of money and seeking to park that money to make that, to put that money to work to generate returns, they may very well, you know, upset that that balance of kind of supply and demand, producers and end users. And so once the financial institutions actually step into that intermediary role and become the traders in those markets, both in the financial derivatives, commodity derivatives markets, and in the physical commodities markets, then we're talking about a qualitative change, at least potentially, in how the market operates. And I think that's what we're seeing today. It's very difficult to figure out exactly, you know, why a particular commodities price is spiking at one point, not at the other point. You know, it's difficult to get a handle on what determines these prices at this point.
So you, of course, testified today, Sole Amorova, before this Subcommittee on Financial Institutions and Consumer Protection, part of the Senate Banking Committee, chaired by Senator Sherrod Brown. There was, of course, a representative of MillerCoors, who are the end users for aluminum cans, which they put their beer in, and they're obviously feeling the pinch from the gaming of the aluminum market. What part of the picture did you cover in your testimony?
So I'm a banking law scholar, so I viewed my job as setting forth the broader legal and political regulatory implications of this phenomenon, namely large U.S. financial institutions becoming effectively physical commodity and energy merchants. So I looked at the potential policy concerns that, for example, are triggered by this phenomenon. You know, do we worry about, for example, the safety and soundness of our banking system because the bank's affiliates or sister companies are now actually drilling for oil or operating oil tankers? Do we worry about systemic risk implications of whatever risky activities these institutions might be conducting, market manipulation, consumer protection concerns? What about, you know, oversight and regulation? Is there currently a single regulator, for example, capable of effectively overseeing all these activities that, you know, spread around so many different sectors of the economy, not just finance? And so those are the concerns that I try to bring up to the attention of the senators, basically making an argument that perhaps this potential concern can be easily alleviated if we had enough data and enough information on what exactly is going on and how it's all being managed and what kind of consequences for the market, for the end users of commodities, for the society in general, these things may have. However, my task today was to emphasize the need for that inquiry.
So in terms of what happened with the repeal of Glass-Steagall, where the wall that was put up since the Depression between investment banks and banks was taken down, and it obviously led to, in part or in whole, if you will, to the crash of 2008. And now, of course, Senator Elizabeth Warren and Maria Cantwell and John McCain are trying to bring back Glass-Steagall. Mm-hmm. So was there a similar wall that existed between banks and the ownership of the means of controlling commodities and pipelines and warehouses and oil tankers and drilling for oil, etc. Was there a wall that was taken down in the way that Glass-Steagall was repealed?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, one of the foundational principles of U.S. banking law is the so-called principle of separation of banking from commerce, which basically says a banking institution should not be engaging in commercial enterprise in order to avoid potential conflicts of interest and risks to the safety and soundness of that bank and so on and so forth. So since 1863, when the National Bank Act was adopted, the banks themselves, in other words, the deposit-taking institutions, have been generally prohibited from engaging in anything that is not banking or business of banking, and that was a fairly narrow term. So other than gold and bullion, they couldn't trade in any physical commodities. Now, in 1956, Congress passed another statute, the Bank Holding Company Act, and that statute explicitly imposed similar activity restrictions, not only on the banks themselves, but also on bank holding companies or their parent companies. So now, any company that owned or controlled the bank, directly or indirectly through any subsidiary, was generally prohibited from engaging in any commercial activity other than a very narrow band of certain very small passive investments they could make under the law. Now, the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act in 1999, when it partially repealed the Glass-Steagall separation between, Glass-Steagall Act by, allowing the affiliation of commercial and investment banks, also, in addition to that, provided certain additional sources of authority for banking organizations, for the bank holding companies, not banks themselves, but their parent companies, to conduct commercial activities. So in that sense, Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act not only eliminated the wall between commercial and investment banking, but also significantly relaxed the prohibition on bank holding companies conducting purely commercial activities. So that happened in 1999, and then, not surprisingly, in the early 2000s, once the commodities boom started, this was a point at which those bank holding companies, Citigroup and Bank of America and J.P. Morgan, started coming to the Fed, asking them to allow them to trade physical commodities, pursuant to the new authority that Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act created. So in that sense, yes, the Gramm-Leach-Bliley Act not only eliminated the separation between commercial and investment banking, it also significantly undermined the separation between banking and commerce.
So, Sola Ambarova, obviously the banking lobby is, I think, considered one of the most powerful in Washington. But when you've got people that were testifying today against the gaming of commodity prices and the growing power of banks to influence, if not control, the prices of basic commodities, and in this case, aluminum. So you had the representative from MillerCoors, and presumably you would also, people, for example, like airlines would be concerned about the price of gas, refineries would. I mentioned earlier the big food agribusiness companies like Pillsbury and Kellogg's, they're concerned about the price of grain. Is it possible that those kind of companies can act as a counter-lobby against the banking lobby, which clearly has got its way so far?
You know, in a healthy pluralist democracy, that would be an assumption, that whenever one special interest group gathers too much power, there will be a countervailing, set of interests that would actually oppose such concentration of power. And under normal circumstances, that's how it's supposed to work. However, something changes when the banking lobby, right, or whatever, the banking industry, the financial industry that accumulates all that power sort of becomes a major player in these commodity markets. Because when, if you think about it, when Coca-Cola is facing Goldman Sachs, in Goldman Sachs' capacity as a warehouse operator, right, and Coca-Cola is very unhappy about what Goldman Sachs is doing as a warehousing operator, perhaps they would have, been much more aggressive in pushing somehow, Goldman Sachs back to, where it should be. if Goldman Sachs was just a standalone warehousing operator, right? But in this case, Coca-Cola is looking at the situation and says, is it really a wise move for me potentially to go into this open political fight with Goldman Sachs? Not only because it's powerful, but also I am tied potentially or maybe in reality to Goldman Sachs in so many other ways, right? For example, Coca-Cola may be obtaining credit from Goldman Sachs or, you know, another banking institution. It may be retaining Goldman Sachs to underwrite its security issuances, advise it on various corporate transactions, provide various hedging solutions along a variety of lines. In other words, the grip that Goldman Sachs may have over an industrial company, even a large corporation, potentially powerful corporation, may outweigh this sort of expectation that we normally have that in a pluralist democracy, these companies will just lobby against Goldman Sachs and everything will get back to some kind of normalcy.
Well, just in closing, Sola Elmarova, what can citizens and consumers do? Because at the end of the day, they're the ones that are getting gouged. Every time you go to the gas pump or put food on the table, you're paying a premium for the speculation that goes on that's driven the price up and adds absolutely no value to the economy. It's just a form of extraction at the top at the expense of the middle class and working Americans. It really feels like we're subsidizing a bunch of parasites. So what can be done in terms of political action here to get the middle class and working Americans to assert themselves against the power of the banking lobby?
That's a very important and a difficult question in some ways. Well, first of all, I think people, the American public, should start paying much closer attention to what's going on in the banking regulation, financial regulation area. To the extent possible, try to educate themselves, try to follow the news, you know, and not let the industry and industry lobbyists to fool us by telling us that everything is great, you know. And perhaps if people, you know, attempted to exert greater pressure on their elected representatives just to look into this issue, to quiz and to probe the industry rather than take everything, you know, on faith. Maybe that will help.
Well, Sola Elmarova, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
Again, I've been speaking with Sola Elmarova, who is a professor of law at the University of North Carolina, where she focuses on regulation of financial institutions, banking law, international finance, and corporate finance. In 2006 to 2007, she served at the United States Department of the Treasury as a special advisor for regulatory policy to the Undersecretary for Domestic Finance. And today, she testified before the Subcommittee on Financial Institutions and Consumer Protection of the Senate Banking Committee, chaired by Senator Sherrod Brown. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Claire Goldsmith. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.